I have to use the podcast as a platform to get some to get something out there, Shale.
Okay. You're going to be getting it out to a very select group of people.
But I think it's the people who I need to get it to.
Oh, perfect.
When I was just starting out cooking, I read a book called Soul of a Chef.
Oh, yeah.
By Michael Rollman, which has come up a few times in our conversations. Mm-hmm. And it was very inspirational and influential to me. It's the story of three stories. Brian Poulsen, Chef Brian Poulsen, going for his Master Chef certification. Michael Simon of Lola in Cleveland running an insanely popular busy restaurant. And Thomas Keller and how he operates the French Laundry. Really,
it is such an inspiring book.
Yes, really, really inspiring. And besides that, the actual book that I had, because I was starting out, this was before I went to culinary school, but I had been accepted. So every time I came across a term I didn't know, I looked it up and I wrote in like directly in the book. So there was like footnotes and stuff in the margins. And this was like,
cool.
Yeah. And I realized fairly recently that I don't have this book anymore.
Oh no.
I was like looking for it on my shelf and I was like, I almost like tore the office apart. I was like, I know it. Like it wouldn't be anywhere except on these shelves. But then I think I have a dim memory that I lent it to someone.
Oh, someone. That is such a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
This same thing, Alan, happened to me with a guitar that I once owned.
Oh, really?
I lent it away. I'm not sure to who. Mm-hmm. And it disappeared forever. And yeah,
it's so weird that you could forget,
heartbroken
that you could forget something like that.
Yeah, it's way worse to forget. It's way worse to forget an entire guitar than it is a copy of Soul of a Chef. Mm-hmm. But here we are.
So I'm just putting it out there. I'm not pointing fingers. I'm not blaming anyone. I'm not going to be upset.
No, of course.
But if someone listening to this podcast has my copy of Soul of a Chef from those years ago, I would love it back.
Oh, geez, I should check my bookshelf, Alan. Hang on.
Do you remember? It did come up once that you said that you lost your Modernist Pantry precision scale that goes to a hundredth of a gram. And I realized that I had it. I still have it.
I think I told you at the time that I have another one, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I will legitimately take a look at my bookshelf.
I
don't think I would have it because I have my own copy. You would have had no reason to lend it to me.
Exactly.
So. And I know where my copy is. So.
I'm not going to say names, but I've got two people in mind who I think it could be. one of them
maybe that's follow up for the next episode. If nobody responds.
Right.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my pal, Alan Sutterby. How you doing, Alan?
Great.
Happy Thursday.
Thanks. Is this a new thing?
Whoops. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. It's going to suck, because we always release the episode on Wednesday, so that right. is never going to make sense.
Yeah. Anyway.
How we doing, Alan?
Good. It's spring.
Yeah.
The plum trees in bloom.
Oh, that's nice. Oh man, yeah. I should swing by your yard. I'll bet you have cherry trees there that are almost in bloom too.
Yeah, they're a little bit behind the plum.
A little later.
The plum is like full on snowball mode now.
Wow.
Big white flowers.
Cool.
Yeah, cherries not too far behind though.
I accidentally skipped over a piece of follow-up last time.
Okay.
Maybe it was because I was like embarrassed, and so I just like blocked it out of my mind or something. But
okay.
I had mentioned that I was gonna procure and try some balut, but I haven't done that yet, and the reason why is just because I'm way too busy to try and do it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I will take a crack at trying to do it again before we record next. Mm-hmm. But things are a little bit crazy for me right now because I'm getting ready. as I think I mentioned in the last episode, I'm getting ready to leave for Japan right away. In fact, just looking at my calendar here, when the next episode is released, I will be at the airport getting ready to board my flight. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, that's this episode.
Yeah.
My brain is really broken. Yes. Okay, dear listener. If you're listening to this episode on the day that it is released, not only is it not Thursday, like I alluded to in the opening, but it is Wednesday, and I'm about to board a plane. Oh, wait, no, I lied. I'm actually boarding the plane on the 18th. So, yeah. So tomorrow, listener, I'll be getting on a plane and flying to Japan. For the first time ever, first time I will have ever been to Asia, actually. Mm-hmm. I've done quite a bit of traveling in North America and in Europe, but none in South America, none in Africa, none in Asia, none in Australia, none in Antarctica. So that's most of the continents I've never been to.
So you've been to Europe.
I've been to Europe. Yeah, yep. Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, it's super exciting. And so right now I'm in the middle of trying to plan everything and get everything together and figure out all of the things that I really want to do while I'm there so that I don't come back with horrible FOMO.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I thought maybe for this episode, Alan, you could help me do a little bit of food planning. I haven't written down everything that I have on my list of things that I want to try, because if I wrote everything down and tried to talk about it on this podcast, we'd be here for 5 hours, literally. Mm-hmm. I'm not kidding. Mm-hmm. But I have written down a few things, and I was hoping I could maybe go through this list, and if there's glaring omissions that, you know, things that don't come up where you're like, you didn't mention this, mm-hmm. that you could bring them up. Or, you know, if you've heard of variations on things that I'm thinking about trying and you'd like to suggest them, then that would be great.
Right off the hop, I've got to say, just so that you know,
uh-huh,
I don't know anything about Japanese food.
That's interesting. That is obviously not true.
Yeah.
Which is rare. Yeah. It's rare for you to say something that is just straight up a lie on the podcast. But I think I understand your meaning. I mean, in the broader context of everything that exists in Japanese food, mm-hmm. Like maybe you don't have as much exposure to it as some other cuisines that you have, you know, at different times, like been involved in, like cooking a lot of, or, you know,
right,
other places where you actually have been to the region where the food comes from and have been able to do some research on it and stuff
but
like that.
To give you an idea of what I mean, like we were, most of my exposure to Japanese food has been through like the old North American sushi places. Or the right. The izakayas, like Izakaya Tomo and Dorinku, which we just mentioned. But to give you an idea of what I mean, when I go to Dorinku, there are things mm-hmm. that I know I like to eat and I still don't know the name of. And so I use the pictures as an example from our last conversation.
Okay.
I use the picture. So like there's that kind of crepe that has cabbage in it and it's finished uh-huh. with mayonnaise and the bonito flakes. And the mm-hmm. flakes are like waving at you when it's served. Like, I don't know what that's called, but I like look at the picture on the menu and ask for it.
Okay. Well, that's called okonomiyaki.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. And that is definitely on my list. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, names are kind of tough, especially when they're in a language that you're not really exposed to. It's kind of, you know, hard to remember a word that like has no lingual context for you, so that's not mm-hmm. that surprising. But you're aware of okonomiyaki.
Yes.
Which I think, I mean, I would say that sort of proves my point. Because I think that a lot of North American people are not aware of okonomiyaki.
Right. Okay.
Or I'll bet you know what takoyaki is.
Octopus balls?
Yeah. octopus pancake balls.
Yeah.
yeah. And, you know, I bet that there are a lot of North Americans who are also not aware of what that is. I guess like izakaya food is becoming more popularized. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, you know, for a long time, most North Americans, when they thought of Japanese food, they mostly exclusively thought of like sushi or maybe udon or ramen. Mm-hmm. And then maybe
teriyaki.
Yeah, but the name for, well, like, I guess like teppanyaki.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or there's one more.
Yakitori.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, gyoza was the thing that I was thinking
of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So dumplings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously, like with most cuisines, there's like, you know, just a huge range of different things and different styles of cuisine and different regional cuisines and mm-hmm. Things in Japan. And so there's just like this vast tapestry of things to try. And once you start, you know, and like a lot of my exposure to Japanese food, you know, has just been obviously from like eating in North American Japanese restaurants. I think maybe the one thing that's slightly different for me is that I have had a bit of an obsession with the broader Japanese regionality and stuff like that. And so I've done a lot of research about it over the years, and I've really been into trying to discover new Japanese food and trying out new styles of Japanese restaurants whenever they open up in a place where I have access to them and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. Japanese food is sort of like one of my
hobbies,
super favorite bucket list cuisines.
Mm-hmm. Can we start with sushi? Cause I would feel a lot of anxiety about getting the sushi experiences that I need going to Japan. Like, are you,
okay.
I assume that there's like lots of opportunity for casual sushi, but are you seeking out any of the, like the Michelin starred ones or the famous ones? Are you going to go see Jiro? Are you going to?
Yeah. Oh man. I wish I was going to go see Jiro. You know what? I might even just like go stand walk outside Jiro.
Yeah.
I might go walk by it. Honestly, like if there's time, I will probably walk by it, but there's no way to get in. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, like there are a ton of like really amazing, well-renowned restaurants in all of the cities in Japan that I'm going to be going to. There are, you know, in Tokyo, I don't know how many restaurants there are that are on the San Pellegrino top 50 list, but like there are several, mm-hmm. you know, but unfortunately, like every restaurant that is like renowned like that or has 3 Michelin stars or something like that is basically impossible to get into unless you really, you know, like I would have had to start a year ago,
right?
Basically.
Yeah.
And most of them don't sell the tickets for the night that you want to dine until 3 months ahead, and they sell them on the day mm-hmm. 3 months ahead. And even if you, and some of them, even on top of that, have a lottery for who can actually like apply to get a ticket on that day and stuff. Right. It's very competitive to try and get seats at most of those places. Mm-hmm. And by the time I started looking into trying to maybe eat in a place like that, it was just too late and going to be impossible to book at a table at anything that's like extremely high end, mm-hmm. Which honestly,
that's fine. It's fine.
I'm not heartbroken about no. Like, you know, I like to try to have like really amazing, memorable dining experiences in places that I go to. Because like for one thing, that's, you know, I love food and I love to talk about it.
You're such a dork.
but like because of that, and because I have such a strong connection to it, like I make really long lasting formative memories around that. And I want to have long lasting formative memories of places that I visit, you know, mm-hmm. and that for me is a really good way to sort of like capture those things. Mm-hmm. But honestly, in Japan, like so much of the food is like amazing in that way, even if it hasn't been like recognized by
yep.
a specific body wherein you might go on the internet and be like, hey, like what's the best restaurant in Tokyo or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah.
It spits out a list of like 10 restaurants that you could never possibly eat at. I mean, there are like 1,000 restaurants like just beneath the surface of that list that wherein the food is like, if not equally good, like equally staggeringly yeah. memorable.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I'm not really all that concerned about it. But my actual response to your query about like, you know, am I thinking about trying to get like high-end sushi or, you know, something like that? Or for most of these things that are, you know, sort of like staples of Japanese cuisine that, you know, I'm aware of and that I really want to have some exposure to while I'm there. Like my approach generally is going to be that I want to have like a high end experience and a low end experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know?
Yep.
And so that's probably going to be my approach to like several things, like sushi for one. I want to have like a really awesome high end sushi omakase experience. Mm-hmm. Omakase being like the chef chooses. Mm-hmm. You just go in and sit down and there's a sushi chef and they are, you know, serving usually a bar of people and they're making individual pieces of sushi and like handing them to you directly for immediate consumption. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of up to them what you're going to eat. I guess you probably tell them if you have any allergies. Right. We definitely do that in Japanese.
Yep. Yeah. That makes sense to me.
And so, yeah, that's generally going to be my approach. Mm-hmm. There are a few things that are kind of regional that I want to do specifically in the place where they're like kind of, I don't know, supposed to be from or originate from mm-hmm. or whatever. But for things that are like widespread, like ramen or sushi, and I know that there are regional variations for those things as well. Mm-hmm. But they exist in some incarnation in most places in Japan.
Right.
I want to sort of like, yeah, expose myself to a range of like the varying qualities and the varying presentations that you can have. Mm-hmm. So for something like sushi, I've looked up like a few places where I think potentially I'd be able to go and have omakase. Mm-hmm. But then I also have like a list of sushi conveyor belt restaurants
right.
that yeah. I want to try. and those things are like obviously like complete polar opposites in terms of like the service and probably the quality to some extent and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, like I'm interested in both of those experiences.
Right.
Yeah. And like same for ramen, like ramen is this, okay. This was the one to me that I don't know, for some reason was the most sort of like surprising, but there are several, well, I think, well, maybe this actually, so I think for a while there were five. I think maybe right now there are three ramen restaurants in Tokyo, which have a Michelin star.
Oh, is that right?
Which yeah, which when I found that out, I was like kind of shocked mm-hmm. because in my experience, most of the like, because the Michelin guide has a tier for like restaurants that have amazing food, but that are like more like,
casual.
I don't know, casual.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And ramen is definitely casual food. Mm-hmm. And so I was surprised that, you know, like I would not be surprised to find out that there are a ton of ramen restaurants that have a bib gourmand, which is that designation in the Michelin guide. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are three ramen restaurants in Tokyo which have an actual Michelin star.
Hmm, interesting.
And I was like, wow, this is crazy. And the other thing that's like shocking is that like the like I think the average price for a bowl of ramen is somewhere between like 10 and 12 Canadian dollars.
Okay.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe between 8 and 12 Canadian dollars. Mm-hmm. Like, which just seems like insanely cheap.
Yeah.
For like the amount of food that you're getting and the quality of it. Mm-hmm. I was shocked when I started like looking for like prices of ramen shops. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, this can't be real. But like those Michelin starred ramen shops, like I think the most expensive bowl that I found at one of those Michelin starred restaurants or ramen shops was like 18 Canadian dollars.
Sorry. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Which like you can have a one star Michelin meal for $18.
Wow.
Like, it's, yeah, shocking to me. So yeah, anyways, that's kind of my plan for a lot of those things. Like, try something that's high end, try something that's low end, mm-hmm. find stuff that's in the middle. There's a ramen shop that my sister and I saw in a YouTube video, and I can't remember the name of the channel. Oh, Simply Dumpling, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly not really a fan of the channel.
Okay. Good to know.
So I probably shouldn't have promoted it here, but I don't know. The guy that hosts it just doesn't, I don't know. I'm not super into his vibe.
Okay.
But he goes to this ramen shop that's like in kind of like an out of the way spot, and it's up a dark staircase. He does this on a day when he eats like four bowls of ramen in different places and has snacks in between. I was just like, oh, it's gross, man. It's too much. But he goes to this ramen shop, and it's like a pretty old ramen shop that's been serving like the same pork and fish ramen for like years and years. Mm-hmm. And when he walks in, like the first thing you see that's hung on their wall is like an autographed, like, I don't think it's a picture of him. Maybe it's like a picture of a jersey, but there's like an autograph from Wayne Gretzky, like, oh, prominently really? Displayed on the wall. Oh. And I was like, that is hilarious. I have to go there. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think we are going to try and find this one ramen restaurant right. where Wayne Gretzky ate at some point in the 80s, funny. Probably.
Is there like, so I always find traveling that, we kind of have a tendency to pigeonhole certain types of cuisines. So like, for instance, every Greek restaurant in Edmonton has almost the exact same menu, but obviously you go to Greece, like right. it's the cuisine is much broader than that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of sushi and ramen specifically, do you think that like there are going to be offerings that you haven't seen before that like,
yeah. I mean, definitely there are, like from what I've seen in several YouTube videos and on websites that I've read and stuff, trying to sort of like prepare. Mm-hmm. But the overall kind of sense that I get about Japanese cuisine is that there are definitely a bunch of like traditional forms of ramen or sushi that are like pretty common in Japan that just have no representation in North America. Mm-hmm. And so there are quite a few of those things. I can't really think of too many off the top of my head, but I know that, like, you know, for instance, like in Canada and the States for the most part, and I could be wrong about this, like maybe they just don't really mention it or something, but like, so for instance, with ramen, like what you find pretty often and what is sort of like, I think the most widely popularized kind of sort of authentic ramen that you find in North America is tonkatsu mm-hmm. ramen, which is like a thick pork broth. It's like a very rich pork broth mm-hmm. that has like pork fat emulsified into it. Mm-hmm.
So it's opaque kind of.
So it's kind of like a creamy broth. Mm-hmm. In Japan, there are like several kind of regional varieties of tonkatsu. Mm-hmm. And I think tonkatsu probably has like a specific regionality to it as well. Mm-hmm. But like there are lots of, like I've seen lots of stuff about like, you know, this one shop's tonkatsu also has, for instance, it might be like dried squid added to it, right, for like extra fortification, mm-hmm, or like, you know, and like things like that, that I think are probably fairly traditional over there, but that might not pop up here. And I don't know if there are like ramen shops using dried squid to enhance their tonkatsu in like North America that just aren't saying that on the menu because they think that it'll turn off diners or something like, mm-hmm, that. You know, that could be the case, but that was one thing that I sort of discovered where, you know, like that's not like a, like over there, it's not like, oh, this place is doing something crazy. It's just like, you know, a traditional approach to like, mm-hmm, try and find an interesting way to differentiate your product. And at the same time, like, you know, there's just like this wide palette of flavors that they use in Japanese cuisine that then get incorporated to try and make that differentiation or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And same goes for sushi. Like there are a lot of kinds of fish that don't really get served over here very often, right, that they just have better access to in Japan. And so you, I don't know, find a lot more examples of it.
So then in the sushi space, you have a few ideas, yeah, for like restaurants, high end, low end, and everything in between that you want to go to. Is there like a particular piece of sushi or preparation that you're like, oh man, I really need to eat that?
I mean, this isn't like something that I discovered, but like definitely the top of my list for sushis that I want to be able to try while I'm over there is uni. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's like much easier in Japan to get really good sea urchin than it is in North America. Mm-hmm. And so I think like, you know, even in places where it's sort of like medium tier or something like that, you would still get a piece of uni on your sushi that would like be way better than anything that you could ever hope to get in North America, except at the very, maybe very highest end, wherein I think in a lot of cases, like they're having their fish flown from Japan,
right,
like either daily or every couple days or something like that. So,
okay, cool.
So like uni's the one that sort of springs to mind. I just like, I want to have quite a bit of it because I know that I'm going to find it and it's going to be good. And it's not as expensive over there as it is here. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that there was anything that I saw where I was like, whoa, I've never seen that before in terms of sushi. Mm-hmm. Where I was like, whoa, I've never seen that before and I definitely have to try it. I'm really curious to try like sushis here that, you know, like I think maybe sometimes are ones that are more challenging for people, like octopus. I think, you know, people over here usually find it chewy. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to try it in a really good place in Japan and see if it has a similar texture to what the stuff that you find over here, or if they're like just treating it totally differently there. Mm-hmm. And you know, by the time it makes its way over here, it's just like not getting the right treatment. And that's why it tends to be like chewy or something over here. Right. And maybe it's not there. I'm not really sure, but I'm really curious to find that out. Mm-hmm. So octopus is one for that. And I had like another really good example for that. Oh yeah. Like surf clam. Sometimes you get it here and it's great. And it's delicious, but it's like really popular in Japan, and I'm just wondering if like, yeah, if there are different preparations, like if they use different sauces on it over there and things like that.
Sorry, that's surf clam sushi or just another preparation?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like nigiri sushi. Mm-hmm. It's like a piece of rice with a piece of surf clam, like just on the top of it.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Like eel is one of like, unagi is one of my favorite kinds of sushi, yeah, and I'm really, that's like generally the only way that you find that type of barbecued eel over here mm-hmm. is on sushi. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I'm really excited to try eel in different contexts
yeah.
and things like that. Not necessarily just on sushi or something, but mm-hmm. yeah. So as far as sushi goes, those are kind of some big ones. I'm also just like excited to see something. Yeah. Like I know that I will also go and see something on a menu where I'm like, whoa, that's a sushi, you know,
yeah.
and I'll get to try it, mm-hmm. you know?
And then, so what are your big, tell me about your noodle dreams, your noodle goals.
Yeah, man, it's so hard because like there are so many, I don't know, did I say this on our last episode, but like our list of foods that we want to try. So my sister is going to be with me on the trip for 2 weeks mm-hmm. and I'm going to be there for an additional 2 weeks after that. But we have like a list of foods that we want to try that some, you know, some of them are very specific restaurants. Some of them are just like, oh, we want to, you know, try this type of street food in this city or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we have a list, but the number of things that are on the list is more than there are meals in the days that we're going to be there,
yes.
you know, so we're going to be there for 14 days. So if you say that that's 3 meals a day, mm-hmm. what is that? That's
30.
42. What's that?
42.
42. Thank you. Right. Yeah. So there's like technically 42 meals and we have like 60 things on
right.
our list. But, you know, also a lot of those things are, you know, snacks.
Yeah.
So it's not outside the realm of possibility that we'll get to sort of try everything on the list, mm-hmm. but it's daunting looking at that list and trying to be like, okay,
my tummy hurts.
Maybe this day we can try these 20 things. I don't know.
Well, you'll share.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. A lot of them are sort of like, yeah, street food, like small kind of snacky types of things mm-hmm. and yeah, that we could share or stuff like that. I'm sure we'll get to a lot of stuff on the list, but I'm equally sure that there will be things on the list that we just don't have an opportunity mm-hmm. to try. And that is heartbreaking to me.
I'd be curious to try. I don't think I've ever had really authentic soba. Like I know that there's dedicated soba restaurants, right? Just like there's dedicated
yeah.
ramen restaurants. Yeah. And I'm basically only aware of it because of David Chang's in the Momofuku cookbook, he talks about going to Japan to work and he's working at a soba house and the owner finds uh-huh. out that he's actually into ramen and he's like, you have to choose right now. Is it soba or is it ramen?
And Chang's like, you don't know what it's like over there, man. Like you don't have to choose anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do whatever you want for 30 seconds yeah. and nobody cares.
And actually, I do remember yeah. Can you remind me? Maybe it was that. I know that you had a soba noodle salad at Little Brick, but maybe it was also at District mm-hmm. for a while. And was there not a Japanese employee who made a comment to you that it would be super weird to have soba served in a restaurant like this in Japan? Do you remember that?
I don't actually remember that.
Oh, that's so funny.
I mean, I remember the salad. I don't yeah. remember that comment specifically, but.
Anyways, I'm interested in soba houses.
Yeah, me too. That's definitely on the list. And there are several, like, I'm aware of several like soba houses where you can go and watch the soba master make the noodles that you're going to eat.
Oh, is that right? Cool.
Yeah. Like they make them right in front mm-hmm. of you. Like you can watch the process of making noodles and then they make the noodles for you mm-hmm. and you eat them. And yeah, I'm really excited for that actually, because if there's one thing that I think like, you know, with sushi, I think there's a pretty good opportunity to sort of like transplant that. And I feel like I have had pretty good sushi in North America. I've had some like pretty high end sushi meals and I feel like I've had probably what's a realistically pretty like what realistically is a pretty good representation of what good sushi is like. Mm-hmm. And same goes for ramen, you know,
yeah.
like I'm sure that I'm going to have ramen while I'm over there that is going to like be totally mind-blowing in terms of its like flavor and composition and texture and things like that, but like I think I can kind of imagine what that will be like.
Yes.
But to me, like my idea of what the soba noodles that the dried soba noodles that we can get in North America, even if they're like an expensive Japanese brand or something like that, mm-hmm. compared to the soba that you get that's handmade in a soba house, right. like that to me seems like it's going to be like, I can't imagine
yeah.
what that is going to be like. I can't imagine what the difference is going to be like. Like, to me, I love soba. I love eating soba noodles. I wouldn't have put it on several menus if I wasn't somewhat obsessed with it. But, like, to me, that's the one where I'm like, oh, I feel like I have never had actual soba.
Right.
Yeah. You know, even though I'm kind of somewhat obsessed with it.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. It's like the difference between growing up on boxed pasta and then having fresh pasta
and then going to Italy and having someone roll out a giant sheet of pasta in front of you. Yeah.
So ramen, soba, and udon, are those, am I missing any important Japanese noodles?
There is what's it called? Somen?
What's that?
It's not as popular. And I don't exactly know what the deal is with it. I think it's a maybe it's a rice noodle. It always looks very white, so maybe it's a rice noodle, mm-hmm. actually. Forgive my Googling, Alan.
Google, the death of conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no. They're made of flour. They're stretched, apparently. And I don't... Like, I think it's more of, like, a... Like, a lighter... presentation kind of dish. Like, it usually comes with like pickles or vegetables or things like that, mm-hmm. but I saw a video of a somen restaurant where the hosts like went to this place and you sit in front of this like it's like a little bamboo trough that runs in front of where the diners are sitting, mm-hmm. on an angle, and there's water running down it. And there's like a person serving the somen who's standing up at the top of this little bamboo trough, and they like prepare the noodles and they're served cold. So they like, I guess, cook them and then cool them down. And then they take little bunches of noodles and they put them in this like little bamboo water slide, and they slide down in front of you and you have to catch them with your chopsticks and eat them. And they just keep putting noodles on this thing until like you are so stuffed that you can't eat anymore. It just seemed like so hilarious to me.
Yeah, that's weird.
It seemed like such a fun eating experience. I don't think I'll get to do that, but
I think I would want to be one of the people more upstream in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. It feels very out of control.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily for me. I would feel also because, you know, at least in the video, the person who was serving them, you know, was obviously very proud of the noodles. Like, and so I would feel bad at some point saying like, no, I can't eat anymore, you know, right. And that point would probably be like long before most of their guests that come there to eat as many noodles as they can. So, yeah, I don't want to put myself in that situation, I don't think. Anyway, getting back to your question. Ramen. Soba, udon, somen. There's also tsukemen, which is like cold ramen. Mm-hmm. I think that still counts as ramen. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like as an outsider,
yep.
judging what that's like. But it's often like it's often the same noodles that are served in ramen,
right.
And it's often served in a ramen shop. So I think it still counts as ramen, okay. if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I think
those are the important noodles.
I think that's most of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about
the broad categories of Japanese noodles?
Yeah. Tell me about street food.
Yeah.
I know that's a broad category, okay. But.
Yeah, it's sort of like the most overwhelming mm-hmm. kind of category that I have. There are so many, like, when you're like researching traveling to Japan for food, like most of what you see is street food, mm-hmm. You know, because that's a lot of like when in the touristy areas, that's a lot of what people wind up eating is basically you just like, you know, there's like a whole street that's basically just restaurants, and out front of every restaurant, they have a cart or something, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. they, you know, street food is big. And it's, yeah, totally overwhelming. Like the amount of different things that I've seen in YouTube videos that I want to try is just like way bigger than that list of 60 things. Like, you know,
yes,
that list of 60 things is like broad things. Like,
is one of the ramen, 60 things street food?
Ramen okay. is on the list of 60 things, yeah, you know, yeah. like. That's one thing on the list of 60.
Right.
If I started writing down all of the individual like things that I've seen, street food that I've seen people eat, that list would be like at least 250 items long.
So what are some of the must have? I know, like, I know you said it's overwhelming, but what are, give me some preparations.
Okay. So, let's see. I'll try to narrow it down to sort of like my must-haves. So at some point we're going to be in Osaka, and there's like, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but there's like this kind of huge market slash street food kind of district. All the restaurants have like these huge animated, like animatronic signs. Mm-hmm. Like if you've ever seen videos of people in Japan and they're like... walking out front of restaurants and there's like a huge crab with arms that are moving like gigantic, or like, you know, a chef with a cleaver and right. his arm moves or something like that. Most of those places, most of those restaurants are in this one area in Osaka. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty crazy. But a lot. So like one of the street foods that's like very popular in Osaka is takoyaki. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be a big one, I think, when I'm in Osaka. And then also in Osaka, there are a lot of places that serve ikayaki, which is like takoyaki, but with squid instead of octopus.
Okay.
Taco being octopus and ika being squid. Mm-hmm. And I've never had ikayaki because like takoyaki is something that has somewhat been popularized in North America, but ikayaki not at all. And squid is one of my favorite foods, and so I'm like super excited to try ikayaki. Like most of the I'm trying to be like I just want to get there and see what there is, because like every video I watch, like they try a piece of sushi from a street vendor and it looks friggin' amazing. Mm-hmm. And then they go to the next street vendor and they have like fresh tempura that's like, you know, of like 50 different varieties that you can choose from. And then the next vendor has like all these croquettes, like a potato croquette and a pork croquette. And like, mm-hmm. they all look amazing. But yeah, like, a lot of the street food is either like fried food that you can walk away with. So like a pork bun or something like that, like a dumpling, mm-hmm. or a croquette or something that you can hold in your hand, or sweets. So like there are a lot of like different kinds of mochi as well. There's like a very popular sweet called dango, and it's, I think, very similar to mochi, but it's like mochi balls on a stick.
Oh, okay.
And then sometimes they are like grilled and then have like savory sauce put on them, and then sometimes there are ones with sweet sauces and things like mm-hmm. that. I think they're mostly usually intended as like sweet, as like a confection or something like that, mm-hmm. but some of them are still like kind of savory.
Yeah.
So yeah, dango is a big one that I want to try. Oh yeah, there's like 1,000 sweet street food desserts that have red bean paste in them. I'm really excited to try. Yeah, I'm really,
I didn't know that was a Japanese thing. Like I associate that with Hong Kong to me, like only because of Hong Kong
totally.
Bakery here in Edmonton. But
me too. And just from like, yeah, you know, from like various other like Chinese sweets that I've had, often they have red bean in mm-hmm. them. I didn't really realize that it was popular in Japan, but yeah, apparently it is. There are like tons and tons of things that have anko is what they call mm-hmm. it. in Japan.
Actually, I think spurred or inspired by our pancakes from Fua Fua, I did try another Japanese dessert place called Pablo. Apparently there's style of cheesecake that's popular.
Yeah, Japan. Totally. Yeah. I've had Pablo cheese tart before.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really good. They're like, it is an actual Japanese establishment. Like, there are actual Pablo
cheese
tart shops in Japan.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Which I didn't realize until I started looking around. Mm-hmm. You can actually get a Pablo cheese tart in Tokyo and various places. Yeah. Street food. What else? Oh, God. Like, one of the craziest things that I've seen is a street food, and I'm still like waffling back and forth on whether I'm actually going to go eat it or not because it's kind of pricey. Mm-hmm. But I've seen a few videos of people going to a stand in Tsukiji Market, which used to be like the largest fish market in the world. The fish market is no longer at Tsukiji. It's at another market right now that I can't remember the name of right now, which I am also going to go to. But in Tsukiji, there's a stand that sells skewers of like Wagyu steak that are grilled. And then like it's a big skewer. It has like probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 like 2 ounce pieces of like really nice Wagyu sirloin. Mm-hmm. And then they like cover the entire top of the skewer with pieces of sea urchin. Right. It looks like maybe, I don't know, like those like individual kind of like pieces that come out of the sea urchin shell. I don't know that this, I guess they're probably called segments. I don't actually know what they're called. But there's gotta be like 12 of them on there or something like that. And the one skewer is like $60 right. Canadian roughly. Which, if you made that skewer in Canada and had to sell it to a person, it would be like probably $250.
Right. Yeah.
So it seems like a good deal even at $60. Mm-hmm. But man, I don't know. Like, for one piece of street food, I don't know if I can. I don't know if I have $60 for that.
Oh, really?
I guess we'll see.
I thought when you told me about it originally that it was like a, oh yeah, it's happening kind of situation.
Man, I don't know. I'm going back and forth. I guess like the reason why I'm going back and forth is because I'm not entirely certain exactly how much money I'm going to have saved by the time I get there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really want that to happen, but we'll see. That would be, you know, like that would be a splurge for sure. And that would be taking money out of something that, you know, that would be potentially something else, you know, two other things other things, you know, so yeah, we'll see. When I get to the stand, I'm going to that stand one way or another. I'm going there to take a look at it. If when I get there, I just cannot resist, then I'll have a story about it when I come back. If when I get there, I look at it and I'm like, it doesn't look as great as I thought, then maybe I'll be able to talk myself out of it.
Does sake feature in your plans at all?
I mean, it definitely does, but probably not in a way that like is wherein I'm planning on doing a bunch of research to figure out the various things that I absolutely must try. Mm-hmm. Like, it's probably going to be a more organic, like, oh, you know, they have regional sake here and I'm going to try it,
you know.
Or they have a different style of sake here and I'm going to try it, but not something that I've done a ton of research about. I know something, like a little bit about sake production. I've watched a couple of documentaries about it, and it is very cool and it's very interesting and I love sake, but it's just like one of those things where it would be such a deep dive. I just don't even have the time to manage like planning it.
So you don't have plans to visit a brewery or anything?
I mean, probably not. We'll see. Like, I haven't made a ton of plans yet for the last 2 weeks that I'm going to be there. I know that there are a few things that I want to do. like, I want to, like, when my sister is there, we just don't really have time to go to Hiroshima. But once she leaves and I'm there on my own, I have a train pass. I'm probably going to do a little bit of traveling outside of Tokyo. I definitely want to try to go to Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and like, Hiroshima is quite far south, and there's, you know, like, a lot of distance between, like, Hiroshima and, like, I think probably Osaka is the sort of, like, the next sort of big city mm-hmm. that's, like, on the train line, like, north of there. There's a lot of distance between Osaka and Hiroshima. I'm sure that there are tons of, like, little spots where, you know, like, there's probably shops where people are making amazing noodles that are in the middle of some town somewhere that you can just get off the train at a stop and, like, go and discover something. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm probably going to try and do a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And if I happen to run into, like, a sake brewery and have an opportunity to, like, take a tour or something like that, I definitely will. Right. And I think that's sort of what my last 2 weeks are going to be like, just sort of like traveling around and taking my time and trying to discover as much stuff as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. But yeah. We'll kind of see how it goes. I have no, like, it's not set in stone that I'm going to go visit a place like that. Some of the things that are kind of set in stone that I know for sure that I am going to try to visit are, like, knife makers.
Yes.
I want to try and go. There's a city called Seki, which is, like, traditionally the most kind of, like, concentrated area for, like, sword and knife making in Japan. Mm-hmm. And, I want to try to go there if I possibly can.
Were you ever able to check out that Springhammer documentary?
Yeah, I haven't watched the whole thing yet, actually. It's on my list of things that I'm, like, trying to watch before I go. Yeah, I want to watch the whole thing before I go. And I don't know if, like, the knife maker that they kind of talk to in that is in Seiki, but I wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. I think they do say at the beginning of it, and then, but I can't remember if my suspicion was confirmed or not. Yeah,
I haven't actually watched it, but the filmmaker Kevin, who made that, was telling me, I think it's in the movie or in the documentary, uh-huh. about this meal they had where there was a pool of fish, and they had these, like, pelican type big birds on leashes. And they had, like, steel rings in the bird's
mouth. Oh my God. Yeah.
So that the bird would fly, dive into the pool, catch a fish, can't eat it because of that steel ring inside. And then the bird would be retrieved.
That is, like, a traditional way of fishing. Right?
Yeah. Okay. That sounds crazy. Yeah. I can't even picture that in my head. Like,
yeah, that's madness, man. I'd love to do that. When we were at lunch the other day too, one of your friends that we were having lunch with said that they went to a restaurant in Tokyo, I think, where you put a fishing rod into a pool and catch a fish.
Those little canals,
and then they prepare
the
it.
Yeah.
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 You actually catch a fish and then they prepare it mm-hmm. for you. That is also pretty hilarious. Yeah. So, yeah, things that are kind of like must-dos are, yeah, like, visiting knife makers, also, yeah, probably visiting a soba shop where, you know, they make noodles fresh and then you eat them. Mm-hmm. I've seen several videos of, like, soba shops where you can go and make noodles.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I think that would be amazing if I could make that happen. I would love to, even though it's, like, ridiculous and just, you know, like, I'm not going to learn anything. It would be mostly just be, like, a touristy thing. But I would love to do, like, a ceramics workshop.
Oh, yeah.
Just, like, make a piece of pottery. I know that that's, like, pretty widely available. You can, like, go to a potter and they just have, like, a class for tourists and a teacher that speaks English mm-hmm. and you can make, like, a teacup or something like that.
What about cooking classes? Would you do any of those?
I mean, I would love to. I think that anything that would be, like, surface level, that would be, like, an hour or two, like the soba thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like, yes, like that, you know, like, you know, it's not really a cooking class. Like, they, you know, you get to do this thing once or something. Right. I, you know, like, but I, to me, it doesn't really feel like a cooking class. I, you know, there was an option when I first started planning this trip for me to like start doing a bunch of research to find out if there would be like a place where I could potentially stage at for a day or something like that. And I did really think about the idea of trying to do something like that, but it honestly seemed pretty complicated and pretty hard to find a place where it would be okay for someone who doesn't speak any Japanese to go and to actually have it be effective, you know? And so I kind of set the idea aside. I mean, if an opportunity like that presented itself to me somehow, I would definitely take it. But yeah, it's not something that I like really made a plan to try to do. And so I don't think that something like that is probably going to happen, unfortunately.
The, when Lisa and I went to Italy, we did cooking classes, and at the, when I was first thinking about it, I was like, oh, it's going to be, it's kind of touristy. And like, I know how to cook and all that, but they were actually some of the most memorable things that we did. We did one in Bologna and one in Alba.
Right.
And especially the one in Alba was in a restaurant, like not in just like a, you know, cooking school. And it was awesome. Like to see how they did it in the restaurant was really great.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. If I have opportunities in the last 2 weeks that I'm there to, observe in restaurants or something like that, I'm going to see if I can make something like that happen. But yeah,
there's probably also,
there's a lot to pack in.
Like there's, I imagine lots of, like not necessarily traditional Japanese, restaurants that like we don't really have access to and don't have versions of in Edmonton. Like I know like Joao Robuchon has a bunch of restaurants in Japan and what else am I thinking of here? But yeah, other kind of dining experiences like that.
Yeah. So well, like there's in Kyoto, there's a style of dining service called kaiseki, which is like this traditional multi-course meal that I definitely want to, that like I don't think that there are really examples of that in North America. I mean, there probably are somewhere. Someone's probably doing it somewhere.
But I remember one of the chef's tables, there's one in San Francisco, but anyways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but they're pretty few and far between and not very well known, I think. And so that's definitely something that I want to try and check out. There's like a burgeoning kind of like microbrew culture in Japan right now. Yeah. I'm definitely interested in like trying to check out some like smaller, like I really like Japanese beer, but most of the examples that we get of it in Canada and the States are, you know, just crisp lagers. There's a little bit of variation, like you can get Hitachino Nest or whatever.
And actually that I was just thinking with that Corso 32 New Year's Eve menu that we talked about last episode, the crispy rabbit tortellini was paired with a Hitachino Nest white ale.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, it's a delicious white ale. One thing that we haven't really touched on yet, like a whole sort of like an entire like food cultural phenomenon in Japan that we haven't touched on yet that I'm very interested in like deep diving into is convenience store food.
Like hamburgers out of a vending machine kind of thing or...
Yeah. So vending machine food, food that you can get at the 7-Eleven or Lawson. So there's two main sort of like convenience store brands in Japan. It's 7-Eleven and Lawson. And the food that you can get at convenience stores in Japan is apparently like amazingly delicious, well prepared, like inexpensive but high quality like meals. I've been saying for months that the very first thing that I'm going to eat when I get there, like as soon as I get off the plane, I'm going to immediately find a convenience store. They're called Konbini. I'm going to immediately find a Konbini and have an egg salad sandwich. The egg salad sandwiches are supposed to be amazing.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a big thing.
Okay.
And so that's what I'm going to do. As soon as I get off the plane, I'm going straight to the very first like Lawson or 7-Eleven that I see and getting an egg salad sandwich.
Okay.
But they have just like all kinds of stuff like hot food. Like you can buy what's basically like a cup noodle where you could just like pour boiling water into a bowl, but it's like, you know, like a legitimately reasonable facsimile of real ramen.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
They have onigiri, which is like a rice wrap that like it's rice wrapped in nori that you hold in your hand and eat kind of like a sandwich. Mm-hmm. And they often have like stuffings inside them. So they'll have like tuna mayo is a popular one. So like it's just like rice with tuna and mayo stuffed inside of it. Mm-hmm. and wrapped in crispy nori. And I don't know, I think it's funny because like if you bought something like that at a convenience store here, well, like first of all, they would never have onigiri at a convenience store here, but food that you would buy in North America at a convenience store would be, what's the right way of putting this? Like it would be prepared in a way that is the least possible care that you could put into making sure that it was a quality piece of food. Right. You know, like it's sort of like the very bottom of the barrel experience in terms of like if you buy a sandwich at a convenience store here, like nobody cares if like the piece of lettuce that they put in the sandwich is like completely wilted by the time the person that's going to eat the sandwich buys it. Right. And the sandwich probably sits on the store shelf for like 2 or 3 days before they sell it or something like mm-hmm. that. It is not like that in Japan. Like, I don't know for sure, like how often the food gets like replaced or whatever. I imagine it's different for different products. Mm-hmm. But from like a lot of the videos that I've seen, they have this like really amazing infrastructure in Japan for like providing meals that were prepared that day to people in like convenience stores or like train stations and things like that. That's like there's a whole other thing. There's like bento boxes that you can buy in the train stations mm-hmm. called Ekiben. And they like a lot of them, not all of them, it depends where you get it, but like in the large train stations, like in Tokyo, in like the big stations in Tokyo, if you go and buy Ekiben, there's like a factory somewhere fairly close by to that station, or like maybe a little bit on the outskirts, but they have like, they just have this logistics chain where they start making bento boxes at like midnight, the day before people are going to buy them. They're like made with like freshly made, like prepared that day ingredients and packed into boxes, and then they're all packed up and like put in refrigerated trucks by like 3 a.m. and then they're distributed to train stations and they're on the shelf by like 6 a.m. and then people are buying them by like 6:30 and 7 and then taking them on their train journeys and eating them. Like mm-hmm. the infrastructure to deliver like fresh food, like fresh convenience food like that mm-hmm. just doesn't exist in North America. Mm-hmm. Like the food that you buy like in a train station is either like in sort of a restaurant setting, so someone's preparing it for you like right then and yep. there, or like in an airport or something mm-hmm. like that. You know, someone's either preparing it for you like right then and there, or if you buy like a sandwich in a convenience store, it's, you know, probably a sandwich with a shelf life of 10 days and it's probably 5 days into its shelf right. life by the time you buy mm-hmm. it or whatever, mm-hmm. right? But it's not like that in Japan. They have like this fresh food infrastructure wherein like you buy food and it was prepared like literally hours before. And the reason why is because that's the expectation. Like you would just never eat a bento that had been sitting on the shelf for like 3 days because the food would be horrible. Right. You mm-hmm. know, like the things that are supposed to be crispy wouldn't be crispy anymore. And people would be like, I don't like this. And I feel like in North America, people are just like, I don't like this, but there's no other option. Yeah. And in Japan, people are just like, no, I'm not going to eat this. I'll just eat something that I brought from my house if this is what you have, mm-hmm. you know, or something. And so there's just like this whole, because of that, because of the expectation of quality and because of you know, the pride that people take in the food that they prepare and the food that they eat, like, you know, it would just feel bad to like be preparing something for someone that you knew they weren't necessarily going to enjoy, or that was just going to be like low quality by the time they ate it. Which is really cool, and which is why you can get like crazy fresh and crazy good food in a convenience store. So like all of that is like just a preamble to illustrate this like thing that I've found where like, so there's a lot of products that you can buy in the convenience store that are wrapped in these like really intricate ways to maintain the freshness for like a full day or maybe more than one day or something like that. So when you buy an onigiri, so it's rice that's wrapped in nori, but the way that it's packaged is so that like the rice part itself is like separately packaged, and then the nori is like wrapped around it in the way that it would be once you go to eat it, but it's actually like separated from the rice by like a very thin piece of wrapper. And when you go to open it, you like pull on this one, there's like instructions for how to open it. And there's like, you know, a pull this first. And so you like pull this one like little strip of plastic, and then like the outer wrapper comes off. And then it's like pull this second. And then you pull like another little piece of plastic, and then it like pulls the wrapper that's keeping the nori from getting soggy by the rice, like out from in between the nori and the rice. And then the nori like makes contact with the rice, and then you have this like freshly made onigiri with like crispy nori and soft rice inside. Like no one would think to do that here. They would just wrap it and then wrap it in a piece of saran wrap, and then you, when you go to eat it, everything would be soggy, and everybody would just be like, this is what you get in a convenience store. But it's just not like that there.
Oh, fascinating.
And there's a bunch of stuff like that where like the packaging is really well thought out to try and preserve like the quality of what's inside. Another crazy example of that is I've seen a whole bunch of like like I was saying before, there's a lot of food vending machines, and a lot of it's like beverages or whatever, the same type of stuff that you would get in a vending machine here. But then there are also vending machines where you can get hot soup and stuff like that, some of which are supposed to be quite good. But like one of the craziest ones that I saw is like there are a bunch of vending machines where you can buy a can of like cake. And it looks like a soda can that you would get, like an aluminum soda can that you would get here, except in most cases the sides of the can are made out of clear plastic. Or like acetate, what looks like acetate. And you, when you open the lid of the can, instead of just like cracking a small opening, the whole like top comes off. And then you have this like fresh cake, usually like with whipped cream or custard or something like that, and like it's usually made and brought to the vending machine like that day, or they have a shelf life of like 1 or 2 days, like very short shelf life. There's usually fresh fruit in them and stuff like that, and it's just like, and they're from like these famous bakeries in Japan. And I've watched several people try them and just be like, oh my god, this is like like, you know, they go to the vending machine and they're like, this is hilarious. Cake in a can? You can eat cake out of a can? And then they like buy a can of cake for like $4 or something. And then they open it up and start eating it. And they're like, this is the most amazing cake I've ever had in my life. Like, there's a lot of stuff like that. Things that you would think would just be like lowbrow or not that good, or like novelty food, or, you know, and just like it turns out that somebody really, really cares about the quality of them and has done and has gone to great lengths to preserve the quality of what they're making and selling to you in this really convenient way. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's really neat. Cool. Yeah, so all these things, I'm really excited to try convenience store food. I'm really excited to try vending machine food. I'm really excited to try high-end omakase. I'm really excited to try kaiseki meal. I'm really excited to go to a soba shop and make my own soba noodles. And there's too much, Alan. You have to help me pare down this list. I don't even know what to do. There's also... Oh God. This is a great tangent. Like there's also, I saw in a video, like there are several, I've seen several shops where, you know, like, in a lot of, Japanese restaurants, and this is like true in a lot of North American Japanese restaurants as well. They have like a display of the food that's on the menu in like a case out front, and it's like little plastic like examples of what the food is going to look like. And to me that always kind of seemed sort of cheesy. I was like, oh well, like that's an interesting cultural thing, but like it doesn't seem appetizing to me or something. Like but like when you start to think, like I guess maybe in my head I was like, oh, like this must be a custom thing. So like you tell someone, a person who makes display food, I don't know what that person is called. I don't know what that job is called. But like you tell a person who makes display food, like this is the food that's on my menu. It's a bowl of ramen and it has surimi and a whole little anchovy on top or something. And then they like, then they craft it for you, you know, like custom. And I'm sure that that must be the case for a lot of things, but like there are actual shops where you can go and there's like actual like little plastic foods of like every kind of food that you can imagine. Right. Like the walls are just lined with like the cutest little plastic foods you've ever seen in your life. Like this section of a wall is just like 100 different kinds of nigiri sushi, and then like right beside it there's like 30 dumplings, and over here there's like stacks of piles of noodles, and then like all kinds of fruit segments and all kinds of like, it's crazy. I want to go to one of those shops so bad and just like, I don't know, like find the cutest dumpling keychain or something like that.
That's good. I like, my kids have a little play kitchen in the living room. And it has like, I think it's some like felt vegetables, like stuffed felt vegetables from IKEA, and actually some that my mom sewed for them and stuff. But maybe I'm going to look for one of those places online to see if I can add some more interesting things to their play kitchen.
Well, maybe I'll bring some back for you.
I don't want to burden you with bringing me souvenirs, but yeah, or some sushi for my kids.
I have a strong feeling that like every place I go in Japan, I'm going to see like 10 things that remind me of like people back home and be like, I'm bringing, it's like, I mean, I don't want to spill any beans or anything, but I'm bringing a duffel bag with me to send things back in. Yeah. Both for myself and for, you know, and for my friends. So it's part of the plan, Alan. If you want to
send you a list,
if you let me know, yeah, send me a list. I could probably get lots of little fish shaped waffle that are supposed to have red bean paste and more.
The sushi will be, we're trying to, Cora's decided that she really wants to try sushi, so we're going to make it next week maybe, or once we get an order of fish coming, once we get our fish we'll make sushi for it. But we could, if we could have sushi in the play kitchen, it might open up Oliver's brain to the idea too. So
oh yeah, totally. Well yeah, sushi will definitely be the easiest one to find, I feel like. There's also like an entire street in Tokyo that is, it's called Kapabashi, and basically the entire street is kitchenware shops.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. So you can, you're gonna get your milk bread. What was that thing, that bread you were trying to make?
I am. Yes, that's right.
The Japanese Pullman.
Yeah, so and we haven't even talked about Japanese baking yet, Alan, which is like, it's just entirely other sector of like foods that are, oh man, like every video that I watch online, very specifically like that show that I told you was hosted by Paul Hollywood or whatever, where he goes to Japan and has a real British person's experience of Japan. Like they say several times in that show, like, you know, people don't normally go to Japan for the baking or for the bread or whatever, which I think is just so ridiculous, because if you know anything about Japanese food or anything about like what the baking culture and the bread culture is like there, like it's some of the like it's some of the best in the world.
But
like it's
but they're amazing. Like baking in the Western tradition, or is there a distinct Japanese tradition? Because
a lot of it, I think a lot of the baking is like around Western style stuff. So I don't know how that cross-pollination of ideas really happened or where that all came from. Like most of the pastry shops and things, like the pastries that you see, a lot of them look like things that you would consider to be European creations, and a lot of the bread and stuff like that too. But yeah, so specifically what you're referring to is shokupan, which is like a Japanese milk bread, which is like just a very high quality, delicious, springy, like white bread. And it's baked like a Pullman loaf, but with a lid on the pan so that all of the sides of the crust are like not that deep. Well, actually, there are two different styles. There's the mountain style that looks like a mountain, wherein it's not baked in a pan with the lid on. And then the other style, I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically it's baked in a square loaf pan with a lid on it. And so you get this like perfectly square loaf with really light colored crusts because the crust is baked inside the loaf pan. And yeah, you can buy Pullman loaf pans in North America, but they're usually not the size that you need to make a real loaf of shokupan. And you can on Amazon, you can buy like some perfectly cube loaf pans that are supposed to be for shokupan that are like a little bit bigger than like a traditional North American Pullman pan, which I have considered because... And I've only baked two loaves of shokupan ever, but it was a lot of fun and I wanted to continue doing it, but I just didn't really feel like doing it if I didn't have the right pan. And so I thought about ordering one of these like smaller ones off like Amazon, because you can get like kind of ones that are just a cube but are actually bigger than a regular Pullman loaf pan. But they're quite expensive. And so I was just like, well... maybe I should just try and import one from Japan. But then, and this was kind of before I really knew, I guess it was kind of when I knew I was going, but yeah, I wanted one now. So I was going to maybe try and see if I could get one sent over, but that was going to be really expensive. And then I was like, oh, well, when I go, I should just shop for one. So yeah, I'm definitely getting a pan for shokupan when I go to Kapabashi. And we'll see. I'm definitely going to do some knife shopping there as well, but I think there are a bunch of other things that I'm probably going to try to look for while I'm there. Yeah, it's a lot, Alan. I guess this is like probably this is kind of like a before and after situation. Like we'll probably have to do an episode after, and I'll have to like re-listen to this episode and listen to all of the hilarious things that I have misconceptions about and then go back and correct myself on a subsequent episode after I return.
Exactly,
yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Is there anything that I didn't talk about? Not really. I think we talked about most of the majors on my list. I think like there's lots of also like kind of food hacks that I've seen that I want to try. And I have a few of those on the list, but like one of them being that I've seen a lot of people take that very famous Japanese egg salad sandwich and put like a pork cutlet in the middle of it.
Is the pork cutlet also from the vending machine?
Yeah. Or also, yes, okay. Also from the 7-Eleven. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. There's lots of hacks that I want to try too, but I don't know. It's crazy. I feel like I'm going to get there and then I'll just like all of these like hacks are going to spring up in my own mind that I want to try, like that are completely outside the list.
I have a bit of a Japan related piece of follow-up for you.
Oh, cool.
I don't remember in what context this came up at all, but you were I think it was when we were talking about the Marinetti futurist dinner from fascist Italy, and you started talking about the movie Porco Rosso.
Yeah.
Which is by studio, is it Ghibli?
So it's actually both.
Oh.
it's the Miyazaki. Well, man, should I really get into this?
Well, let me.
In Japanese, the word is pronounced Ghibli.
Okay.
I can't say it very well because I can't say the Japanese like sound that's like kind of like L but kind of like okay. R. But like to my ear and to my pronunciation, when Japanese people say it and the people who founded the studio say it, it sounds like Ghibli.
Okay.
So Ghibli, I think, is the North Americanization of that. The studio is actually named after an Italian plane that was called the Ghibli.
Okay. So
there's a lot of confusion about the pronunciation of it, but yeah.
So you were talking about their movie Porco Rosso, which I had never heard of, and it sounded so bizarre to me. But
which is a great movie.
I forgot to tell you, and I can't believe it's been ages now, but when I was in Vancouver in September, I had lunch at a Japanese place and they were playing Porco Rosso on the wall. They were like projecting it onto the
wall. God, really?
Yeah.
Oh man, it seems like the perfect movie for to have in like a lunch place. Like
I didn't get to watch the whole thing, but yeah, I thought that was funny.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sudeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.